Happy Halloween. It's pretty much Halloween everywhere. Now, well, see, no, we haven't brought Hawaii online yet, but in Alaska, it's coming. But welcome then to all the way out to the West Coast. We are in a Halloween mood, of course, always on Coast to Coast, not just this time of year. We always dip into the Halloween well. And coming up later on, of course, Art Bell will be back doing the annual Ghost to Ghost show on Coast to Coast on Sunday night. Always fun. Open lines, just 4 hours taking your calls, ghost stories, fun around the old campfire. We're talking about something a little bit more sinister, though. A political witchcraft. What does that mean? How have we been victims of it? And I'm going to have him switch gears here and not just talk about these dark forces, which often overtake our political process. But also some of the geography of the United States and how it has influenced the rest of history. In particular, one patch in Kentucky whose effect is still with us. And the number of people and the number of events that get tied back to this one piece of dark and bloody ground in Kentucky coming up next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Sinister Forces from Peter Lavenda. This is book one of three, and we're kind of hitting some of the highlights, maybe of all of them. But let me just ask you, if for people who are just joining in the conversation, what you mean by political witchcraft, Peter?
Political witchcraft is, well, it's the use of power. And power is, base at heart, it's an occult force. You know, when people become very invested in power and seeking power and going after power, they don't pursue it along what we would consider normal avenues. They will look for shortcuts, and these shortcuts invariably become, to my mind, what we call political witchcraft. If you look at American history, if you look at some of the most famous events of American history, our most traumatic events, you're going to find that they're surrounded by this weird web of what appear to be coincidences that multiply and multiply like crazy around these events. And to me, that's always the indication that maybe it's not a conspiracy the way we normally think of it, but that maybe these coincidences are evidence of a darker force at work. That when we seek after power so nakedly, so deliberately, we sometimes contact, consciously or unconsciously, these same forces. And forces like this can be in a geographical place as well as in an individual person. So political witchcraft is the use of less than savory practices to acquire political power. It's a recognition that sometimes these events that we undergo, like assassinations, that seem to be the result of conspiracies, but we can't put our finger on it exactly, that maybe there's another alternative
Right.
to looking at history, something that's not either coincidence or conspiracy, but a third way of looking at it. And that's what I call the sinister forces.
And just like the occult, what we see is a history in the United States of people using objects and words, and almost like the repetition of words like spells to try to influence events and to control people in ways in which they are innocent of at the time. They do not know it's happening to them until it's too late.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's the famous cases of people who spoke no German, who went to the Nuremberg rallies when Hitler was speaking, and they were moved to tears. I mean, so to tremendous emotion, and they didn't understand a word the guy was saying. I mean, there is this power, and there's a definite power in words. In India, it has a word. There's a name for it. It's called mantra, and you recite these words over and over again, and you reach an altered state of consciousness. Well, in political witchcraft, you don't want to reach that altered state of consciousness yourself. You want the masses to reach those altered states.
Sure.
You want to be the person in the driver's seat. You want to be controlling their reality.
This is book one, the nine. And so before we get to that geographic reference you made, and we'll talk a little bit about the dark and bloody ground of Kentucky, what do you mean by book one, the nine, as a subtitle to Sinister Forces?
Well, I build up in book one to a discussion of a group of very wealthy American families, famous named American families, Astors, DuPonts, Forbes, that met at a farmhouse in Maine for a seance. And this is very well documented in a number of places, just that people are not that aware of it. And it was in 1952 and 1953, we had a group of nine individuals who met for the purpose of the seance. And during the seance, which was run by an officer, a military officer, who was stationed at Camp Dietrich, which was our chemical biological weapons location, he was trying to investigate the paranormal because he wanted to weaponize the paranormal. This was during the Cold War, the Korean War. He thought that there was a way to enlist occult powers on behalf of a military or government program. This is taking, you know, the idea of political witchcraft to its logical conclusion. So here was the seance, and these nine individuals were contacted by, allegedly, nine spiritual beings floating above the earth. You could call them extraterrestrials. You could call them spiritual forces. It's a little vague. But they were given their marching orders by these nine extraterrestrial beings. And they were told, essentially, we are nine and you are nine. And you're going to make have tremendous impact on what's going to happen in the world. It's your duty. It's your responsibility. You know, you're going to go out and cause changes to occur. One of the members sitting there was a man called Arthur Young. He was the inventor of the Bell helicopter. And Arthur Young had given up engineering and military science to devote himself completely to a study of the paranormal. His wife was a woman called Ruth Forbes Payne Young. She had been married a number of times. And they lived in Pennsylvania. Okay, the story is interesting to that point, but it doesn't end there. Because Ruth Forbes Payne Young, Arthur Young's wife, had a daughter-in-law called Ruth Young. And Ruth Young was living in Dallas, Texas. And she was the person that Marina Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald were staying with from time to time. Mm. It was Ruth Payne who got them, who got Lee Oswald his job at the Texas Book Depository.
Sure.
I mean, so we have this weird connection. So a few months before the assassination, Ruth Payne, you know, with her house guests staying behind in Texas, Ruth Payne goes up to visit Arthur Young in September of 1963. We don't know what was discussed, but how could she not discuss the fact that she had Russian defectors living with her, right?
Right, so, who'd already made the news. I mean, they were already a headline item, so it wasn't, I mean, of course they're going to have a conversation about him. The fact that he had left the country and then come back was mainstream news.
Yeah. A military defector, you know, from a radar base, no less. And the U-2 flight had gotten shot down, and all this other stuff was going on. So, you know, Ruth Payne then comes back to Dallas, you know, and Marina is staying there with Lee's children. And Lee is, you know, working at the Texas School Book Depository. The assassination takes place. Okay, and it's, of course, Ruth Payne is being very helpful with the police and giving them photographs of Lee withholding the gun and all kinds of other stuff. And, you know, you're thinking to yourself, well, my goodness, what are the odds of this? You know, and then you look a little further and you read the Warren Commission documents, the interviews. So here's Ruth Payne, the lady from Dallas, and she's being interviewed by Alan Dulles and the other members of the Warren Commission. And every time she gets close to talking about Arthur Young going up to Pennsylvania and all of this, Alan Dulles steps in and changes the conversation. It's very funny if you read it, but it's obvious. He keeps changing the subject. I wondered why, you know, and I started to backtrack there, and I realized that, you know, Arthur Young's wife, her best friend was Alan Dulles's mistress. So there was this weird, you know, nexus of events.
Yeah.
Surrounding Oswald with these people called the Nine, and that's only one. We just discussed one of the threads. There are a number of them, which made me take a very serious look at the Nine, because Uri Geller, you know, came out of that. I mean, the guy who ran the Nine was Andrea Puharich, the guy who discovered Uri Geller and brought him to the Stanford Research Institute in California, which was, you know, being run by intelligence agencies to see if they could weaponize, you know, Uri Geller's paranormal abilities. I mean, all of this stuff was phenomenal. I started reading this and uncovering it, looking at documents, talking to people, and I was absolutely amazed that, you know, all of this is taking place. On top of which, George de Morenschild, who was the Russian, debonair Russian guy, you know, who was introducing Lee to the Paines and all of this in Dallas, George de Morenschild was also close to the nine. You know, he, as we found out with his documents, when after he committed suicide, there was address books and everything else, and we found out that he was connected to the nine. You know, Lee Oswald had no choice. I mean, he was surrounded by these people.
Right.
You know, this non-entity, basically, you know, this Russian defector, he comes back and he's surrounded by people who have direct connections back to a seance that took place in 1952.
Fascinating. Book. That's why book one is subtitled The Nine. So it leads up to this particular seance, but the other books, too. I mean, Peter Lavenda's writing style is freewheeling, making these connections as you read them in real time. It's very interesting. And one of those that comes up early in this is the study of the certain geography, certain places, as opposed to the people that was inhabiting them at the time. And this idea that somehow Kentucky is special in a dark and bloody way, you make the case for by looking at the number of things that happened in this one part of Kentucky. And it really begs the question, going back to what we talked about in the first hour about the spirits of Bobby Mackey's music world, whether there isn't something to this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I didn't think so initially. When I started researching this part of the book, my only goal was to visit a town called Ashland, Kentucky. And the reason I wanted to do that is because Charlie Manson grew up there. And not only Charlie Manson, but right across the river from Ashland in West Virginia, Bobby Joe Long, a serial killer, was born and raised. And then not too far from them, and just at the West Virginia-Virginia border, Henry Lee Lucas, you know, was born. And I'm thinking to myself, it's like a Bermuda Triangle of serial killers and mass murderers.
Right.
What is it about this particular part of the country that seems to attract, you know, or produce these people? So I decided to take a look. And book one is about me, you know, getting in the car and, you know, and driving through West Virginia and into Ashland. And that's when I realized there was something to geography, because as soon as you come into Ashland, Kentucky, you see the Central Park, which is a bunch of Indian burial mounds right in the middle of town. And I thought to myself, well, this is bizarre, you know. And trying to find out what was in those burial mounds and who built them was almost impossible. I mean, no one seemed to be able to tell me what was found inside. Evidently, they had been opened and then they had been closed. The restoration was done by a Boy Scout troop. I mean, it was just so strange. And the town itself, I don't want to malign Ashland, Kentucky. You're going to start getting calls. But there is a very strange building there. It's a huge apartment building that has two griffins on its roof, sort of like the cherubim from the Ark of the Covenant, you know. And they're on top of the roof. They're very strange. And if you read the town's brochure, the town brochure says they're strange. They said they're typically there to ward off evil. And as I'm reading the brochure, it also mentions the fact that that entire building was moved from one or two blocks away to its present position, right in a line with the Indian burial mounds, and it doesn't say why. Now, moving that house was quite an undertaking, I can tell you. This was a huge building.
Right.
Why would you move a huge building two blocks away? You know, uproot the whole thing from its foundations and cart it over to two blocks and then, you know, align it directly with the burial mounds. So my mind was, you know, was slipping over here a couple of times. I'm thinking, Charlie Manson grew up in this town. So what was going on here? And that's when I researched Kentucky. And, of course, the word Kentucky does mean dark and bloody ground. The Native American population itself had a hard time with the territory. And with West Virginia as well. You don't find much of evidence of Native American population in West Virginia. You know, indigenously, there just weren't any. Why did the Native Americans avoid that part of the world? You know, what was wrong with it? You find very little evidence, but you do find ancient evidence, evidence of ancient cultures in Kentucky and in West Virginia and in Ohio, which points to, you know, the old people, as they're sometimes called, the ones that were before the Native American population, which is a controversial subject.
Sure.
So but the bombs are there.
So what do you think it is? What do you think that is then? I mean, that should produce these serial killers. And then how do we tie that to Bobby Mackey's music world?
Well, I think it's part of the guest you had on previously talked about, the fact that there's a river that runs north in that town. I mean, there are geographical, anomalies. There's weird stuff, in that area between West Virginia into Kentucky and up to Covington. That whole stretch, man, has some very strange stuff. Ashland itself was the site of a massacre, a horrible series of events. There was a murder of three children on Christmas Eve in that town. Two girls and a boy. A boy was handicapped, and this was about 100 years ago. And these three children were left alone by their parents. I don't understand that whole thing, but the father went someplace in West Virginia. The mother decided to visit somebody in Ohio. So the three children are left alone in this house on Christmas Eve, and they're horribly murdered, and the house is set on fire. Well, all kinds of people are trying to find out who did it. They bring in detectives from out of town. Everyone's trying to find who did it. They find some guy who kind of claims he did it, as I'm not sure about it. They arrest him. They arrest two of his friends. And they're going to take them to jail and be tried. But the people won't have it. They attack the jail. The National Guard, essentially the militia, is called out. And there is a massacre of townspeople as the troops try to take away these three convicted killers on a boat. They have to fire on the people. The people are firing on them. And it's called the Ashland Tragedy, the Ashland Massacre. A Christmas Eve murder, three children. None of it made much sense. The newspapers in Ohio said this was, the people they arrested did not do it. There were hints of there was maybe some satanic activity involved, some cult activity. There was all kinds of speculation. But in the end, these three people were hung. I mean, they were executed. One died, I think, killed by the mob and hung on a tree in the middle of town, and the other two were executed. So, there was just such violence, such horrible, senseless violence in that part of the country. The famous Hatfield and McCoy feud,
sure,
took place in that area. I mean, there was this inexplicable types of violence, and I used to think maybe it's something in the water,
Right.
Ashland's chemical company is right there, belching all sorts of stuff into the air when I was there, turning the sky gray with pollutants, I imagine. I mean, all sorts of things were going on. And then, Charlie grew up there.
Well, how about this? What if areas of the country, say Salem, Massachusetts, we'll use that, or this part of Kentucky, or even the CIA, that the pattern of history as we look at it through your lens and sinister forces is that anytime an area or a group of people becomes isolated, there is a devolution, that people devolve into something else other than their best selves?
Well, I think maybe there's a tie between the two. It's perhaps people tend to devolve in areas that are conducive to that too, perhaps. I think it's interrelated. You may have certain geographical areas like the areas we're talking about that used to be a locus for other cultures that we don't know anything about. And communities tend to gravitate there. For some reason, we have this tendency to build prisons on the side of Indian burial mounds.
Really?
Through Ohio and Chillicothe, Ohio, where Henry Lee Lucas was kept. Was built on the site of a large Indian burial mound in Moundsville, West Virginia. That's where Squeaky Fromme was kept, one of the Manson killers.
Sure.
And that's not the site of an Indian burial mound. And for those of you who want to go to the UFO direction, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, built on the site of an Indian burial mound. We tend to put our military installations and our prisons on these sites. Is it something in those sites? Is it, is there something sinister about these places that tends to make us build, prisons,
Right. Why are we attracted to that particular spot right there?
Yeah.
Sinister Forces, a grimoire of American political witchcraft. Book one is The Nine. We're talking with Peter Lavenda. There's also book two and book three. You can order all of them You'll know Peter Lavenda best perhaps for his expertise on the area of Nazi occultism. So even though we're talking about American political witchcraft, Peter's already mentioned the fact that one of the aspects of political witchcraft is how we got tied in with the Nazis before and after World War II. And we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So as great as this country is, there have been some sinister forces at work at it. When are we at our best and when are we at our worst? And what are the circumstances which tend to define our worst? Well, that is the subject of the book Sinister Forces, discussing the idea of political witchcraft. And one of those deals with the devil that this country has made over the years, we know now, it was the deal that it was making with Nazi Germany on the rise. And even after we knew the full extent of the evil of the Third Reich, the way in which we continued to engage them after World War II. And what we engage, we become more like. That is part of the book, Sinister Forces. And so we'll talk about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So as we talk about the deals with the devil that the country has made from the very beginning, and sometimes it's reflected in the way in which we get caught up with how smart we are and how much we are like gods, and therefore we can do whatever we want, or whether it's the way in which we make a deal with the devil and the fact that we're willing to give away our own beliefs in exchange for what we think is a more important achievement. Explain how we got involved, the true dark nature of our Nazi involvement before the war and after the war, Peter.
Yeah, I think it's important, first of all, to understand that the Nazi Party was not a political party the way we understand political parties. The Nazi Party was a cult. It wanted to replace Christianity and Judaism and all the other religions with a Germanic paganism. And it was heavily involved with occultism. And I make that case in Unholy Alliance, of course.
Yes, you do.
I also bring it up in Sinister Forces. So if we start from that premise, we have to realize that we're not just dealing with a bunch of politicians when we're talking about the Third Reich. So in the 1920s, in the 1930s, you had people like Henry Ford. The Henry Ford, the inventor of the Ford automobile, was a major contributor to the early days of the Nazi Party. I mean, he sent money to Hitler in the 1920s for the Beer Hall Putsch and after the Beer Hall Putsch. So he was actually a supporter of Hitler from the very beginning. He was tremendously anti-Semitic. And his writings are now being translated and reproduced all around the world in countries that don't like us as proof that at least one American got it right. You know, he was an anti-Semite, and, you know, he believes what we believe. So white supremacists are reprinting his works. Islamic extremists are reprinting his works. So this is a guy who was the poster boy for American industry on the one hand, but he's having his picture taken in Munich at the Brown House with Hitler, who's awarding him the highest honor that can be awarded, Hitler becomes chancellor. So you have this in the beginning. So you have a certain kind of pro-Nazi feeling, not only with Henry Ford, but with a lot of industrialists and a lot of bankers and a lot of people with money and investments overseas. So that started in the 1920s, went through the 1930s. There was the famous case of Brown Brothers Harriman, of course, trading with the enemy. This was some of the firms with which Prescott Bush was involved in the Bush family. They were involved in supporting, you know, this kind of thing.
And they were profiting. It wasn't just involved. I mean, they were making enormous profits on the rise of the Third Reich. And long after the government was telling them, hey, get out of this, don't be doing this, they continued to the point where Prescott Bush had to be formally reprimanded, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and the company had to be closed. I mean, they were still dealing with the Nazis after Pearl Harbor. So it was in 1942 when finally the U.S. government said, we've had enough of this. You can't be doing this anymore. and they stopped it. But it was basically a slap in the face. It wasn't really anything serious because ITT was still doing business in Nazi Germany during the war. In fact, the head of the SS, the counterintelligence, Walter Schellenberg, was on the board of ITT through the entire war. IBM, as we know now, was supplying the IBM machines to do the calculations for making sure the trains to the death camps ran on time. I mean, there was a lot of this. You can find it in a lot of books, interested, listeners. There's Trading with the Enemy is a famous book about that. There's the book about IBM is out as well. So, I mean, the documentation is there. We're not making any of this stuff.
Nothing new there, except when one looks at it in terms of the kind of the greater overall picture of what was happening. And they weren't alone. And so you got Henry Ford, you have the Bush family, you have other people that were making enormous amounts of money, knowing full well what Hitler was up to and not caring, and then continuing to do it even after the war.
Well, yeah, and even when the war was over and the reality of what the Third Reich had been doing was revealed and the death camp footage was everywhere and all the newsreels and all the movie theaters in America and around the world, even then, there was this desperate attempt to get as many Nazi scientists on our side as possible, to recruit them, to bring them to the United States to help us with our space program, the famous Operation Paperclip, but also Reinhard Gehlen's organization, which became basically the CIA's European operation, staffed entirely by former SS intelligence officers. I mean, we made so many deals, with these people. We gave them great jobs, and eventually Dornberger, who was the guy running Peenemünde, sending the V-2 and V-1 rockets to demolish London during the Blitz, this guy then becomes, chairman of the board over there at Bell Aerospace. I mean, all of this was terrible, and people like Albert Einstein was writing letters of protest. Eleanor Roosevelt was trying to get it stopped. There was a big meeting in New York trying to force this to stop, but no one would listen. Even Harry Truman tried to have it stopped, and the Pentagon basically ignored him and brought over all these guys.
Right.
We sold our soul when we did that. When we said, oh, we'll forgive you guys, for all of the atrocities you've committed. And in the case of Dornberger, Wernher von Braun and the others, they were employing slave labor. People died building their rockets. It's unbelievable.
Right.
And Hubertus Strughold was sent to Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, where he created the space medicine operation. And when they tried to name a building after him a couple of years ago, the people in the local community raised a protest. They said the guy was a Nazi. He was a Nazi responsible for terrible atrocities.
Right.
Yes, he worked for us until the end of his days, but come on, let's not name buildings after him. But this is...
No, I feel that same way every time I fly out of Lindbergh Airport at Minneapolis-St. Paul.
There you go.
Yeah. I really do. I was like, I think it's time to not... I think let's take this one down. So how does that fit into the framework of political witchcraft?
Well, because of all the tentacles that ran out from there and leached itself into the American political environment. Once the Nazis were brought over, once the scientists were brought over, and the intelligence people and all the rest of it, there was a tendency to woo these guys and to woo their connections back in Europe. There was a tendency to gain their political favor, to gain their political support. They started to have an influence in our political process. And again, I reiterate the fact, the Nazis were not politicians the way we understand it. The Nazis were true believers. These people were as close as we would come in the 20th century to imagining a satanic cult in charge of an entire country. And if you can just remember that and get away from the Hollywood versions of the Nazis to what they really were, what they really represented, we brought in, to be a little bit hyperbolic, we brought in Satan's, minions, and ensconced them in our society, and thought that no evil would come of this.
Right.
We bartered our soul for this. So political witchcraft started there. We had this horrible, example of Richard Nixon when he was running for president, trying to sign up as many of these guys as possible, trying to sign up the neo-Nazis and the Nazis and the white supremacists to get their vote. We have the World Anti-Communist League which was a major supporter of Reagan's presidency. And the World Anti-Communist League was composed largely of people who had escaped Nuremberg, you know, both from the European theater, both the Nazis and the fascists from Asia as well. So you had all of these people getting together. I mean, the Ukrainian connection is fascinating as well, because the Ukrainians during the war were anti-Soviet because their country had been taken over. So there was an entire Waffen-SS division composed of Ukrainians. And when the war was over, we brought the entire division home. I mean, we took as many as they wanted, we brought back into the United States because they were anti-communists. It didn't matter they wore the Nazi uniform.
Right.
They were actually SS. So we didn't care, you know. On and on and on and on. You know, we've made these deals. We've made these compromises. You know, we always say the end justifies the means, and that's why we behave that way. And that's dangerous. You know, and that's part of it. The Nazis understood political power. They understood political witchcraft in the sense that we've been talking about it. The idea of manipulating consciousness, the idea of manipulating reality. I mean, psychological warfare, the term psychological warfare, is a German creation. It started with the Germans. It started with the Nazis. It was called worldview warfare in its original, Weltanschauungskrieg. So yeah. That was worldview warfare. And that is really what they honed to a fine art, and then we copied it. And the guy who was in charge of our psychological warfare in the European theater of World War II under Eisenhower then became the guy running Time Life, right? And he was the guy who actually bought, for instance, the Zapruder film, which was the only film evidence that we knew of at the time of the Kennedy assassination.
Sure.
I mean, there's dark, dark connections, you know, everywhere.
I think the overall feeling as I'm reading through, again, we're talking with Peter Lavenda about sinister forces, is that it's a very small world at a certain point. It becomes a very small world and everybody knows each other. And if they don't know somebody directly, they are, as you describe it, two handshakes away.
Right. It's an incredible thing because that you keep coming across the same names. What started me on this path was Watergate, you know, and when the Watergate happened, and I'm reading the newspapers voraciously, you know, trying to figure out what's going on. And I keep seeing these same names that were familiar from the Bay of Pigs, you know.
Right. And the Kennedy assassination.
And suddenly I'm thinking, wait a minute. How did all these people show up again?
What are the odds that they all should be?
They're incredible.
Right.
You know, of course, there's Nixon talking about the Bay of Pigs thing and all of this. And then E. Howard Hunt just recently passed away, you know, and admitted on his deathbed that there was a conspiracy to kill the president, and it's admitted that he was in Dallas that day.
Yeah,
and no one's paying any attention.
Actually, I don't know that. I have to be honest and say, I don't think that E. Howard Hunt admitted he was in Dallas that day. What he admitted was that he had been invited to be in Dallas that day. I'm going back over we've played his deathbed testimony a couple of times on Coast to Coast, and I don't think he went, but he knew all the parties that were involved. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds right. It sounds like he recognized everyone, knew who they were, what they were doing there. Right.
He was naming the people that were there, but he wasn't there because this was kind of his same old crony group, you know, where then they were calling him up going, "Hey, dude, you know, we got a new thing." And he said, I'll sit this one out. But he knew who it was, and he was getting it off his chest. So in this way, though, how are we affected today? Before we get to the calls, how are we affected to this day from political witchcraft? Where do you see the influence the greatest in the current events?
Wow, I mean, that's a big question. And I don't even know where to begin. But let's just say that we're at one of the most hotly contested elections right now, midterm elections in my memory. It's gotten violent, it's gotten mean, it's gotten nasty. And I'm looking at, again, some of the same faces from before, you know, keep turning up and turning up. It's we're being manipulated. We're being manipulated in incredible ways. We're being told not to think too much. And this is exactly what we've gone through. Every time political witchcraft has, you know, raised its ugly head, it's been the same thing. There's been a lot of hyperbole. There's been a lot of jingoism, a lot of sloganeering, you know, and very little of substance that's actually being discussed calmly. And when that happens, when the essence of manipulation of a community, of a nation, of a race, is emotion. You throw the emotion out there, and you can, once you have the emotion roiling, then you can aim that weapon almost anywhere you want to. And that's the essence of witchcraft. That's casting a spell, you know. No reference to Christine O'Donnell here, but this is actually what witchcraft really is. It's casting a spell. It's changing reality. And emotion is at the heart of this kind of power. Political power is emotional power more than anything else. You have to have the emotional commitment to it. And that is what I see taking place. This worries me a great deal.
You know,
I sympathize with everybody on all sides of the problem, on all political sides of the political spectrum. I really do. I sympathize with their points of view. But what's happening now is ugly, you know, and it's manipulation. It's manipulation of consciousness.
I guess, especially after reading the part about Kentucky, no small coincidence then that one really scary-looking video of somebody who's with MoveOn.org, an organization I'm not particularly fond of, but you know, the woman that got her head stomped on at the Rand Paul rally, of course it would happen in Kentucky, where somebody just walked up and just stomped on her head, claiming afterward that he wanted to bend down and hold her down to the ground, even though she was totally subdued, even though there was nothing that was going to happen except she was going to show her sign. I mean, it wasn't like she was armed. She wasn't dangerous. But then he just stomped on her head. And that is indicative, I think, of it. That somehow seems emblematic of where we are on both sides. There's just so much rancor and obviously a lot of things are at stake. But that's the nature of that kind of witchcraft then that you talk about, not to be literal about it, but that when somebody casts a spell and you hear the spell and it's cast on you, it gets in your head. And so much, I think, of where we are in our political process is just in our head. We just got a bunch of things that are stuck in our head that people are told us are true, and don't you see it happening? And you get people to be convinced that they can see something that may not even be there.
That's Salem, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that's Salem spectral evidence, isn't it? All you had to do was have somebody lying on the ground writhing, talking about how they're being tormented, I'm being tormented. And people say, well, look, there you go. She's being tormented. There must be demons coming from these witches running all over this person, or she wouldn't be doing that, even though they're looking at it with their own eyes and they really, other than seeing her screaming, they don't see anything at all. There's nothing to see except what the person is calling to your attention and getting you to focus on.
And that's what we're dealing with right now in the political, you know, dialogue is spectral evidence. That's all, you know, we're dealing with. People streaming, you know, and you're looking at them, and it's like a kind of possession, you know. And don't you see the demons? Yes, I see the demons, you know. And everyone's doing that. And when you're talking to them, and I have spoken, you know, to some of these people, I've tried to talk to them, and their eyes are glazed over. I mean, they are so emotional and so at the mercy of these emotions, of things that are impossible to believe, you know. And I write about these things. I mean, I write about conspiracies, and I write about, you know, esoteric stuff. But, you know, I know that some of the stuff they're telling me is just, you know, too far out even for me. And yet they believe it sincerely. And, you know, they can believe two completely contradictory things at the same time.
Right. I'm with you on that. I catch evidence of that sometimes even within the same phone call. Somebody will say something that's completely contradicting what they'd already told me. But for them, they're not looking to make a comprehensive theology or a comprehensive catechism of their beliefs. They just, in this instance, they believe it this way, and in this instance, they believe it another. And that goes back to that emotional base that you spoke of.
Yeah.
But that's how other people play upon us. That's how we get played. That's how we get used. That's how forces that are not in our best interests, but only in their best interests, those sinister forces manipulate us, manipulate our current events, manipulate our history, just to make themselves further wealthier. I mean, we just have to either accept that or we don't. And what we can stand up against is the manipulation. and we can demand that we not be victims of this kind of witchcraft any longer. All right, so coming up in our last hour on Coast to Coast, we'll get to Peter Lavenda and your phone calls. And you know, Peter, you know, expert on Nazi occultism, on occultism in general, which can be a good thing. You know, there's lots of different forms of mysticism in every religious tradition, and that can be a good thing, but it has a dark side. And that dark side is what we so often fall prey to, and we'll get to your calls coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.